This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Last November, former First Lady Michelle Obama released her memoir called Becoming. One of the revelations in that book was that two decades ago, she had had a miscarriage.
I felt lost and alone, and I felt like I failed because I didn't know how common miscarriages were because we don't talk about them.
And Michelle Obama is not alone in feeling alone. Not by a long shot.
It was something that I had no knowledge of. No one around me had ever experienced one. So I felt very alone in going through the process.
And so here I was at work, grieving and physically in pain as I miscarried this child. And I couldn't talk about it. I didn't feel like I could talk about it.
The stigma in dealing with miscarriage is very strong. And I felt like I didn't have anyone to confide in.
And it was all but forgotten. I didn't have extra time off at work. And since then, I've talked to other women who have suffered the same, and they say they've had the same response.
No one needs to feel alone when they're going through something like that. We need to know that it's not our fault. It happens more than we think. It's just not discussed, which I think is something that really needs to be changed.
There are dozens more messages like those in our inbox. And when you know the data, it's not surprising. Up to one in four pregnancies ends in miscarriage. One in four. How could something so common be talked about so rarely and be so misunderstood? Some of those misunderstandings could have impacts in light of new abortion restrictions. They could inadvertently harm women who suffer pregnancy loss. Joining us from NPR in New York is Dr. Zev Williams, the chief of the Division of Reproductive Endocrinology and Infertility at Columbia University's Fertility Center. Dr. Williams, welcome to 1A.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Joining us from WHRU in Long Island is Joyce McFadden, a therapist and psychoanalyst. She specializes in women's health and is the author of Modern Mothering. Joyce, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And here with us in studio, Dr. Jamila Parrott is an OBGYN and a reproductive health and family planning specialist. Dr. Parrott, glad to have you back.
So wonderful to be here.
Dr. Williams, let's get some of the basic fundamental definitions out of the way. First of all, Dr. Williams, what is a miscarriage?
I think you're starting with really one of the critical questions, which is even implying the language that we use. So a miscarriage is when a pregnancy fails. The term, though, miscarriage, has the unfortunate misnomer of something being done wrong. You know, miscarry, just like someone misspoke or they misplaced. So the language miscarriage refers to a pregnancy that has failed. And the challenge that we have is understanding why and what we could do about it.
For the purposes of our conversation, I just want to be clear with you, Dr. Williams. Would you suggest that we not use the term miscarriage for the purposes of this conversation? Is it okay just because it's a shorthand, or is there a better term to use?
No, I think you're absolutely right. Most listeners, most people colloquially will be familiar with the term miscarriage. It's just helpful to keep in mind when we use the language what that implies.
Okay, good to know going forward. By the way, if you listening want to use that term in your comment, it won't negate your comment from our conversation, but thank you for clarifying that. So, Dr. Williams, the difference between what we commonly call a miscarriage as opposed to a stillbirth or pregnancy loss, what are the differences?
Generally, there's somewhat artificial limits placed on when the language transitions from an embryo to a fetus, an intrauterine fetal demise, a spontaneous abortion. All these sort of refer to where in the gradation the loss occurs. Typically, earlier losses in the first trimester will be called an early pregnancy loss or a miscarriage. Later on, it'll be called a stillbirth, or if the pregnancy is still remaining inside, an intrauterine fetal demise.
We'll play as many voicemails as we can in this hour. And again, so many of you called in. One listener here in Washington, D.C. left this note in our inbox.
My name is Erica. I'm calling from Washington, D.C. Last year, I lost my first pregnancy, and I felt empty and isolated. And then I felt angry. And I felt angry because I considered myself an educated individual who cares passionately about women's rights and women's issues. And yet, throughout my entire education, learning about, you know, how not to get pregnant and then how to get pregnant, miscarriage just never came up in a way that was as common as I've now found it to be.
Erica, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. Dr. Parrott, how common are miscarriages? Do we know?
We do. I mean, you mentioned it a little bit in the beginning. We estimate that about 10 to 15 of all clinically recognized pregnancies end in miscarriage. 10 to 15%. Yes, thank you. And that's about 1 million women in the United States annually that are experiencing pregnancy loss every year.
Why do most miscarriages occur? Are there a handful of common reasons, or are the reasons wide and varied?
Sure. Both, I'd say. You know, about half of all miscarriages occur, we believe, because there was something wrong with the pregnancy. I love the way that Dr. Williams described it early, this idea that there something was done wrong. When I'm taking care of my patients, one of the things that I always be sure to communicate with them is that there isn't anything that you did wrong, and that this is often your body's way of taking care of pregnancies that were abnormal and genetically altered from the beginning. In terms of the other reasons why miscarriages may occur, we just don't know. In the medical field, we call that idiopathic. We know that some folks are more likely to have miscarriages as opposed to others, some communities experiencing them at higher rates, but the absolute reasons are not always known, and that can be really frustrating for women who experience them.
Are there certain tendencies, Dr. Parrott, for when miscarriages tend to occur?
The vast majority happen in the first trimester, so at less than 12 weeks, a little bit fewer, up to 20 weeks, and it's very rare to have a pregnancy loss later in pregnancy, but it definitely can occur and does.
And do people always realize when they've lost a pregnancy? Dr. Parrott?
Not always. You know, we know that one of the reasons why we describe the incident as 10 to 15% of clinically recognized pregnancies is that we believe that a lot of miscarriages occur before an individual even knows that they're pregnant in the first place. So someone may miss a period and not realize it, have heavy bleeding, believe maybe it was just a late period that was a little bit heavier than usual. And the likelihood is probably pretty high that that was a miscarriage that was undetected.
Joyce McFadden, and we've been getting some comments from our listeners about how they've dealt with miscarriages in a person-to-person kind of way. Dawn writes, thanks for talking about this issue. I just lost a full-term baby stillborn. It's not a rare thing, I found out, yet not many people want to hear about my, and especially my husband's, pain. Joyce, is that kind of a common denominator in terms of the ways people react after losing a pregnancy?
Well, first of all, my heart goes out to Dawn and her husband. It is common because it's still a taboo subject for whatever reason. And also, it's compounded by the fact that our society isn't so great with grief in general. We like to rush through things. We get consumed by, as listeners, so if someone has just learned of a friend having a miscarriage, for example, and we as the listener of that friend, we get flooded with our own anxiety, and it makes it hard for us to be there to listen to the pain that our friends are going through. And I think that it makes the friend feel isolated, and we tend to our own anxiety rather than caring for our friends in moments like that, just because it's really hard to tolerate watching someone else that we care for suffer.
What are some of the other common denominators in terms of how people react after losing a pregnancy, the pregnant woman, the family members, the immediate family?
Shame is a big thing. Guilt is predominant. Shame, guilt, and blame. And I think there's a general psychological construct that happens there. For example, if you look over your life and you've been treated unfairly by somebody, you might obsess about that. It could have happened 20 years ago. But if you feel you've been treated unjustly and you can't repair the damage with that person, you can't work it out interpersonally with that other person, so it's driven into your head. And what that feels like to people is obsession. We start obsessing about it because it doesn't make sense, and our minds can't find a place for it to land. And pregnancy loss is something similar. Women don't often know what went wrong, even genetically, and their minds and their hearts want to find a place to make sense of it. And so blame is one of the ways that they can try and make sense of it. It's just an illusion. They really are not to blame. But the psychological reasoning is sort of, if I can figure out what happened, I can travel back in time and make it not have happened.
We'll get some more questions answered in just a moment, including talking about some of the policy implications affecting miscarriages. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Thank you. Support for NPR and the following message come from VSP Individual Vision Plans, offering coverage for a low monthly cost if you don't have vision coverage through an employer. You'll get access to the nation's largest network of independent doctors and hundreds of name brand frames. Plus, you can save more than $200 a year. VSP believes you deserve to see better for life for less. Discover for yourself at needvspcoverage.com.
Mitch McConnell has become a champion for conservatives. But back in the day, he once got support from groups like labor unions.
I mark it down as one of the worst things I've ever done in my life.
So you thought about it over the years?
Oh, I still think about it every time I see his face.
Mitch McConnell, a new series from Embedded. Subscribe now.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing pregnancy loss and the enduring stigma around miscarriage and what that might mean as it relates to some of the new abortion restriction laws that are being passed across the country. We have heard so many of you share your stories. The response was really quite overwhelming. Here's a little more of what some of you left in our inbox.
My name is Kate. I'm calling from Greensboro, North Carolina.
This is Margaret in Louisville, Kentucky.
I'm a fairly rational person and knew many friends who miscarried, knew the statistics, and still I was completely shocked with how devastated I was when I miscarried my second pregnancy.
You really don't understand that loss if you haven't experienced it. And I certainly did not understand it fully before experiencing it.
I was gutted in ways that I never had been gutted before and almost felt the need to apologize to my friends for not understanding the depths of their loss previously.
It's a very odd sort of loss, sort of ineffable and hard to put your finger on it because it's not like other losses that are more concrete, so to speak.
I hope that women can continue to learn to not have shame around this loss because it's so easy to feel like you are the one that messed up.
Dr. Parrott, there was a study from the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, that found that Black women were more than twice as likely to experience late pregnancy loss. Pick that apart for us a little bit.
Sure. So we know that women of color, and specifically Black women, experience greater incidence of all kinds of adverse pregnancy outcomes. So whether we're talking about preterm delivery or maternal mortality and morbidity and infant mortality, and the same is true with pregnancy loss, particularly pregnancy loss that's a little bit later in pregnancy, which is what the NIH study described and what you mentioned there. And the reasons aren't clear why this occurs, because when we look at it, controlling for things like education and income, those disparities still exist. The same way we see those continuing disparities in maternal mortality, for example, in Black women. We can't educate ourselves out of it. We can't earn our way out of it. And the question is why? What we do know is that there's no clear genetic predisposition to this happening. It isn't my Blackness as a woman that makes me more likely to have these poor outcomes. And so what that means is we need to dig deeper into what's happening in the systems and structures in our lives to have a better idea of why these inequities and disparities exist in our communities.
Does that change the way, Dr. Parrott, the way that you work with Black and brown women who are your patients in terms of the way you care for them through their pregnancy?
Absolutely. Because what that means to me is I need to really dig deep and have conversations with my patients about everything else that's happening in their lives, right? And so this is what public health folks sometimes refer to as the social determinants of health, right? What's happening where we live, where we work, where we play, where we eat that's impacting our way, the way that we move through the world? We also know that for Black women in particular, the phenomenon called weathering, where the experience of racism and operating and living day in and day out in a racist society and structure impacts the toll that it takes on our bodies. And it really wears down sort of our ability to be able to move through the world in a way that is whole and complete. And so for the patients that I take care of, we talk about all kinds of things that impact their ability to get into the office, to access care, how they're experiencing their health more broadly and not just solely what's happening with this pregnancy.
Joyce McFadden, I'd love to get your response to a voicemail. Here's what a listener on the West Coast left in our inbox.
My name is Kathy, and I'm calling from Pasco, Washington. When I miscarried, a lot of people didn't understand and thought it was just, oh, that pregnancy didn't work out, or it happens to a lot of people. But what it was that I felt I was grieving so much was the loss of an expectation, the loss of all those thoughts and ideas I had about what this baby would be and what it would mean to me and when the baby was going to be born. And I had a whole life imagined for that baby.
Hey, Kathy, thanks for sharing your story with us. Joyce, give us a sense of some of the things that people say after a lost pregnancy that just make things worse.
Well, that was a really eloquent summary, I think, of what happens, that it's not just a child. It's every fantasy of what you would be like as a mother, every fantasy that you've had your whole life. For example, girls, if they're playing with dolls when they're little, the fantasies start there. This is the kind of baby I'm going to have. And so if you've accumulated decades of different iterations of what your child would be like, being born, when they go to school, when they get married, all of these things, it's an accumulation of so much amorphous and highly personal and individualized dreams that it is a bigger loss than just what, you know, what someone might think of as just a heavy period. I brought in some stories from some of my clients, if you'd like to hear any.
Yeah, share one with us.
This is from a woman that I'm seeing now, and I asked her what she would want the listeners to hear. And she said, I want people to know that it was the worst thing that ever happened to me. Even worse than when I almost bled to death months later and lost my ability to carry a child. A piece of my soul died. It is so gut-wrenching because from the minute you find out you're pregnant, it's like you have this little secret companion in you who's already in your mind to protect and keep safe. So it's like your child died. When the twins were removed from me and I woke up from anesthesia, I asked where they were because I wanted to continue to protect them. And it doesn't go away.
Dawn tweeted, have men called in or written about baby loss and miscarriage? I imagine fathers have feeling about this too. As a matter of fact, Dawn, yes, a listener in the South, a father, sent this to our inbox.
Cassidy Anderson, Gulfport, Mississippi. My wife miscarried on September 20th, 2014. We were living in Huntsville, Alabama. They had to induce labor, and we were there for about 10 hours. Every time she would get up and go from her hospital bed to the restroom, she left a little trail of blood, these little small dots on the floor. After she had the baby, she had me drive her to our second home here in Gulfport, Mississippi, and she never came back to Alabama. I rejoined her about 6 months later, and we sort of just had to start all over. New jobs, new careers, everything. At night, when I close my eyes, I can sometimes see those fluorescent lights reflecting off that green tile floor and those little droplets of blood. I think about the baby every day.
Cassidy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. Joyce, could you chime in on Cassidy's comment in terms of how pregnancy loss affects partners?
My heart goes out to them as well. It does affect, because it's such an intimate thing, and I think especially in a situation like his, where your partner is present as the miscarriage or the pregnancy loss is occurring, because it allows you to understand each other and what you were hoping for together, and how the longing it feels like the longing kind of falls out of the woman's body along with the child. And sometimes people are in different places, right? So one person might have been more psyched about the pregnancy than the other partner, or one person deals with grief differently than the other partner, so there can also be a lot of tension and disjunction around how people cope with it. But it does, you know, men should be included in these conversations because it's a loss for them too. And I think that helping them communicate with each other is one of the things that helps them kind of hobble through the grief together.
Dr. Parrott, you wanted to chime in.
I did. I think one of the things that resonated with that caller, as well as what Joyce has said, is that it's important for us all to understand that pregnancy and pregnancy loss doesn't occur in isolation or in a vacuum. We all live in community. We have folks that are around us. And so we can see whomever that partner may be in the relationship, that it affects so many of us that are involved in that care for the person who's experiencing the miscarriage. And so being able to make those connections to people is really critical.
Dr. Williams, one more aspect of pregnancy I wanted to talk about, and I know we're going to get to policy in a second as it relates to abortion legislation. More people are getting pregnant over age 30. Some doctors still consider a pregnancy past 35 to be a geriatric pregnancy. How does age affect pregnancy outcomes?
So geriatric pregnancy, that would be a term we'd also want to avoid. I think over what's interesting today, too, are two factors that are going on with the pregnancy loss. One is the maternal factors that could be important in terms of having a healthy pregnancy. And the other is the very real biology that as a woman's ovaries age, the eggs inside them become more likely to have chromosomal abnormalities. And those, as Dr. Parrott had mentioned at the beginning of the program, are the most common cause of sporadic pregnancy losses. So what you'll find is as a woman ages, especially over age 35 and then over age 40, the chance that any particular egg has a genetic abnormality increases significantly and thereby increases the rate of pregnancy loss because they're chromosomally abnormal. The good thing about that is the chromosomal abnormalities as a cause of pregnancy loss is something that is now much more able to be treated and prevented by things like egg freezing, embryo freezing, and genetic testing of the embryos prior to transfer for women who go through IVF.
Much more to discuss as we continue with Dr. Zev Williams, Joyce McFadden, and Dr. Jamila Parrott. We'll answer some more of your medical questions, and we'll talk more about the policy implications of these new abortion restrictions being passed across the country as it relates to people who experience pregnancy loss. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from the Platinum Card from American Express. Conversations and civil debate in our society push us forward and connect us with the rest of the world. With the Platinum Card, earn 5x membership rewards points on flights booked directly with airlines or with American Express Travel. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Don't live life without it. Visit americanexpress.com/exploreplatinum. Terms apply.
Human behavior doesn't always make a ton of sense, at least on the surface.
I said, would you mind if I give the dogs a little piece of cracker with some hot sauce on it and without and see what they choose?
Hidden Brain, a spicy podcast about science, psychology, and why people do what they do.
Back now to our conversation with Dr. Zev Williams, Dr. Jamila Parrott, and psychoanalyst Joyce McFadden. Elizabeth writes, so deeply appreciative of hearing this conversation. I experienced a miscarriage before having my two children. It was sad, confusing, and unsettling, though knowing the statistics and the biology behind what can cause pregnancy loss helped me to cope. I am a psychologist and talk to my clients about disenfranchised grief with regards to this issue, grief that is not openly acknowledged by society. It is less likely to be mourned in society because it has been such a private issue. Dr. Parrott, can you reflect on the beginning of Elizabeth's comment where she said she had a miscarriage and then bore two children? How do miscarriages tend to affect future pregnancies? Or does it vary?
It absolutely varies. You know, for many patients, the miscarriage is a sporadic incident. It's something that happened and is not a recurrent. For some folks, it is something that continues and they go on to have multiple miscarriages. A lot of it depends on the reason for the miscarriage. And Dr. Williams talked a little bit about all of the things that have to go right in order for a pregnancy to be successful. So if there, for example, are structural abnormalities with the uterus, things like fibroids or other kinds of abnormalities within the uterine cavity or at the level of the cervix, then those losses may absolutely have a recurrence. They may happen with subsequent pregnancies. But if it's an abnormal pregnancy, if it's something that happened earlier along, then it is less likely that this will impact your ability to be pregnant or to get pregnant in the future.
I'm glad you mentioned recurrence because, Dr. Williams, we got a voicemail from a listener about that very thing. Here's what Libby left in our inbox.
My name is Libby, and I'm calling from East Lansing, Michigan. And I myself have suffered 3 miscarriages and gone on, luckily, to have 2 healthy pregnancies and 2 healthy children. And what struck me most when I started to finally be able to talk about my miscarriages was how many women have not only suffered a miscarriage, but have suffered reoccurring losses. And when you are pregnant, you often have a lonely and isolating experience to begin with, and let alone when you are living with the fear that you may not be able to even have kids or that you might have another miscarriage. And so just the knowledge that other women have gone through what you have gone through is a lifeline of hope that really is what was able to let me get through these pregnancies.
Thank you for extending that lifeline just a little bit longer, Libby. Dr. Williams, does having a pregnancy loss once make it more likely that you'll have another one?
It's a bit of a challenging question to answer, because the reality is that everyone who's had multiple losses, so for example, you know, we see patients who've had over 20 losses, at one point they had one loss. So in that group of people who genuinely have something abnormal, they will at one point have had one loss. However, and this is really important, the vast majority of patients who have one loss will go on to have successful pregnancies. In fact, even after three losses, about 64% of the time, the next pregnancy will be successful. And that's after three losses. So while the risk of a recurrent loss does go up with subsequent losses somewhat, simply because you're selecting that population that may have some other effect, people should be reassured that after one or two losses, there's a high likelihood of success, particularly when the losses were due to a genetically abnormal embryo or fetus.
Let's talk policy now, Dr. Parrott. We got another voicemail that kind of walks us into this issue. Here's what Catherine left in our inbox.
My name is Catherine. I live in Norman, Oklahoma. I'm 61. I have four living children and had eight miscarriages during my childbearing years. It became a very private issue for my husband and I. People just didn't ever know. We were expecting until very late in the pregnancy. I can't imagine the fear of mothers now worrying about the government being involved in their childbearing decisions and family decisions. It makes me feel sick. And I appreciated my doctor at the time, and we got through a lot of hard times, but it was nobody's business. It was no one's business.
Catherine, thanks for sharing your story with us. Dr. Parrott, we recently did an hour on new abortion restrictions, and a lot of listeners wanted to know how or if this kind of legislation would affect women who have miscarriages or pregnancy losses. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it's complicated, like many things, when we're talking about policy, and particularly when we have folks who are making decisions in the policy space that impact health care. And so, you know, although politicians and we see in the mass media the portrayal of issues surrounding abortion in terms of binaries, right? It's black or white, it's pro-choice or pro-life. And in the lives of my patient, it doesn't occur like that, right? And so folks have all kinds of things that are happening, and we know that limitations on access to abortion and healthcare more broadly often hit hardest in communities with fewer resources. So whether we're talking about restricted access to the abortion pill, for example, which is also used to treat miscarriages, or we're talking about discriminatory and disproportionate prosecution of folks who've had miscarriages for suspicion of self-managed abortion, or even abortion restrictions that limit training for medical students and nursing students to learn how to perform abortions, all of these things impact the ability of healthcare providers to be able to care for people who've had miscarriages as well.
Wait, back up on that for just one second, Dr. Parrott. You talked about the prosecution of what you called a self-managed abortion. Am I getting that term right?
Sure.
So it's a belief, I guess, on the part of prosecutors, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a woman that a woman miscarried or lost a pregnancy by dint of just her body doing what it did, but that she intended for the pregnancy to end and is prosecuted as such instead of it being purely medical. Is that it?
Absolutely. That's exactly it. So in the United States, since the passage of Roe, there have been 21 arrests and even more criminal investigations related to allegations of individuals who were suspected of inducing their own abortion. The tricky part here is that there isn't any medical way to tell if an individual has taken the abortion pill or medications to induce abortions. They present in the exact same way as a miscarriage. And so for those individuals individuals, a prosecutor has said, well, we don't think that this happened naturally. And they've been investigated and in some cases prosecuted under these allegations and this suspicion.
There's a medical term, Dr. Parrott, that came up in one of our voicemails from a listener just outside Washington. Here's what Allie left in our inbox.
I'm Allie. I'm calling from Prince George's County, Maryland. When I was 28, after having two healthy children, I became pregnant again and ultimately lost the baby at the beginning of the second trimester. I opted for the DNC to have the baby removed from my uterus as opposed to taking a medication that would force the baby to be expelled somewhere while I was at home. And I think my choice was best for my emotional health at that time. The DNC procedure has saved my life.
Allie, thanks for sharing your story. Dr. Parrott, explain what that is, a DNC. Sure. I've also heard the term a D&E. What are those, briefly?
So a DNC is a dilation and curettage. A D&E is dilation and evacuation. And these are the ways that we treat early miscarriages in the same way we take care of individuals who are having an abortion. We gently stretch the uterus and stretch the cervix, excuse me, and remove the contents of the pregnancy from the uterus. When we're talking about the way that this intersects with legislation restricting access to abortion and abortion procedures, there are barriers that have been put in place that limit the opportunities for healthcare providers to learn about abortion care, which then limits their ability to care for people who need DNCs or D&Es for their miscarriages. And so what the caller mentioned is exactly that. There are two options when you're having a miscarriage. You can either take the medication that she described and have the pregnancy pass as if you were having a vaginal delivery, or you can have the pregnancy removed from your uterus in this way.
Dr. Williams, I'd love your reaction to a comment from Brianna, who wrote, I lost a child 6.5 months into my pregnancy. It was a stillbirth, so I went into the hospital and was induced into labor and gave birth. The most helpful resources for me were monetary. I used 6 weeks of California's paid family leave to allow myself time off from work to grieve and heal, and I received money from angelnames.org to cover the costs of cremation. Before we go, Dr. Williams, what kinds of resources are out there for people who are going through this, particularly if the economics of paying for therapy or going to the hospital are out of their reach?
Well, I think there's a few things. First of all, a lot of cities will have support groups. And one of the things that's particularly useful about support groups is you're sitting with others. And that's one of the reasons I want to really applaud the bravery of and courage of a lot of your callers, of Michelle Obama and other public figures who've come forward to share their stories. And, you know, the hope is truly that one day soon it won't require bravery to share the experience of having a loss. It'll be viewed just like thyroid disease and diabetes, that there won't be the stigma around pregnancy loss. And I think that's one of the reasons why getting knowledge and actual information in terms of what's causing the losses, as opposed to them just being unexplained and giving that room for the imagination to take over in terms of what could have caused the loss, is so helpful.
And are there any kinds of national resources before we go, Dr. Williams, or is this really kind of a community by community thing?
There are organizations like Resolve, like ASRM, like ACOG, which will have online information that can sometimes be very helpful. Other websites like Fertility IQ, where they'll have courses and information that can help patients and those who have loved ones who are going through losses.
And briefly, Dr. Parrott, you're a member of ACOG, the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists?
Absolutely. So there's certainly resources on ACOG's website. There are also national organizations that help support a specific community. So Fertility for Colored Girls, for example, is a wonderful resource and Fertile Ground here in D.C. The other thing that I would suggest is that we don't forget about are the importance of doulas and community support people in that way that can help with miscarriage management as well.
Dr. Jamila Parrott, a fellow with the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Dr. Parrott, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
Therapist and psychoanalyst Joyce McFadden. Joyce, thank you.
Thank you for doing a show on this content. I think you helped a lot of women.
And Dr. Zev Williams of Columbia University. Thank you, Dr. Williams.
Thank you.
This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne and edited by Miranda Fulmore. You can learn more about them and the rest of the team online at the1a.org/staff. And this conversation on miscarriages continues online. Please do add your thoughts. We are on Twitter at 1A or comment on our Facebook page. The direct link is facebook.com/the1A show. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for sharing your stories with us, and we'll see you tomorrow from New York. This is 1A.